You know those times when we think we may have hit bottom, a particularly trying time, only to find that the bottom keeps sinking lower? Well, at a time like this, you need to listen to It Could Be Worse. That's It Could Be Worse on the next Mind's Eye Radio. Mind's Eye Radio, it's radio within reach. As I said to my friend, because I am always talking, John, I said, which was not his name, the darkness surrounds us. What can we do against it? Or else, shall we, and why not, buy a goddamn big car? Drive, he said. For Christ's sake, look out where you're going. I Know a Man by Robert Creeley. There's a sick old joke that goes like this. Doctor to parents of a newborn. I have some bad news and some worse news. Parents. Okay, give us the bad news first. Doctor, your child's not a child, but rather a giant eye. Parents, oh, lackaday, but you said you had worse news. What could be worse than that? Doctor, the eye is blind. Well, maybe you think jokes don't get much worse than that, and maybe this time you might just be right. But there are so many times when we think we might have hit bottom in a particularly trying time, only to find the bottom keeps sinking. It is at that moment that we have to conclude what today's Mind's Eye writers have. It could be worse, or it's bad and it's gonna get worse. Anyone who witnessed the heartbreaking pictures, each one sadder than the last, of the recent tsunami may find it hard to believe that things could ever be worse. Perhaps it takes someone who has deep roots in that part of the world's deep ocean to remind us that the sea giveth and the sea taketh away. Mind's Eye writer Rano Catalani is just such a person.
We have, back home on our fragrant islands, an abiding love for our sweet blue ocean. Our elders say our sea's generosity's what makes us as open-hearted as we've always been. Those tender crabs and clams, those thick shrimp and scallops steaming in big tin pots, those silver-scale ikan ma fries fast with only a handful of garlic in her ancient iron wok, arrive daily from our kind sea. Inshallah, God willing. Bellies full, minds at ease, our ocean's sensuous sighs send us into sweet dreams every night. We also have, back on our dependent little islands, a dread as deep as our big blue sea. As far back as any grand auntie's long, long memory, we've suffered overwhelming fits of violence from our ocean. So delicate is our relationship with her, so mighty is her heaving presence all around. The day after Christmas, at about 6 miles under our Andaman Sea's serene face, two massive plates of planet Earth's cracked eggshell ground against each other, quaking Earth 9 points on the Richter scale. No one on our geologically itchy Indonesian archipelago can recall one bigger. The sudden jarring boiled up an unimaginable mass of black water that sent monster waves roaring outward at 500 miles an hour. Earth's oceans, TV news has told us since, are near-perfect transmitters. Blue whale songs carry clear across the cold gray Atlantic. Toyota trucks and Dakota beef circulate easily across our great Pacific basin. Likewise, tsunami waves roll 1,000 miles without losing their ferocious mass. On that day, those horrible waves suddenly crushed everybody and everything in their reach. Screaming, children she tore from hysterical mother's arms in Indonesian and Indian, Sri Lankan, Myanmar, and Nicobar seaside towns alike. Poor locals drowned under collapsed shops, Western visitors smashed against back walls of hotel rooms. Even Kun Pum, grandson of His Majesty, the King of Thailand, perished under those seismic waves. Then, just as suddenly, our angry sea withdrew, doubling back toward her great basin. In her irresistible retreat, she sucked along everything pried loose in every alley of every town, in every corner of everyone's kitchen, and took it all, tin pots and yellow taxis, skinny kids and elder aunties, back out to our big deep blue. 160,000 gasped their last and separated from their sweet souls. An ocean immense and serene lies out there now. An ocean we share, east edge of Africa to west coast America, our ocean of sorrow. This is Ronald Latang Sayang Gatalani for Mind's Eye Radio.
Kathy Miner recalls a moment when, in the midst of preparing herself for one kind of trouble, she's confronted with yet another, which leaves her feeling chastened for feeling just a little put out.
"Oh my God," my sister said, "there's someone in a wheelchair out there." The date was January 6th. We were at a busy intersection on the northwest side of Milwaukee, on our way to a pharmacy to pick up prescriptions for our mother, who'd just been discharged from the hospital. She'd been there nearly a week for treatment of heart and lung problems, and I don't want to say we were feeling sorry for ourselves, but we were pretty well exhausted from running back and forth between the hospital, Mom's apartment, and my sister's house. We were also suffering from having suspended our normal routines, necessary though we knew the suspension was. We're both mothers ourselves, and we well recognize the moment when you realize you have to just drop everything else and attend to the one problem that's staring you in the face. But we also know the sapping of energy that inevitably occurs when you're cut off from your usual patterns and networks. I don't live in the same town as my mother and sister. I'd driven in a 2 hours drive, bringing an overnight bag, as in one change of clothes. By the date of Mom's discharge, it was the fifth day. Just about every night when my sister and I got home, we washed some of my clothes so I'd have something to put on in the morning. Socks and underwear were a priority. I was sleeping in my niece's old bedroom, which still had glow-in-the-dark stars scattered all over its ceiling. I was oddly grateful for them, and for the grudging attention of one of my sister's cats. See what I mean about routines? Anyway, Mom had been sent home, weak but improved, which was an iffy situation at best, because she cares for my disabled brother. There's nothing like a critical illness to teach you that any arrangement can unravel in a hurry. Through the week, we'd been investigating other living and support options for both of them. So there we were, tired and depleted, at the entrance to the shopping center where my mother's pharmacy is. That's when we saw the man in the wheelchair, in the dark, on the snow and ice, in the middle of the busy intersection, rolling backwards. I sounded my horn to alert other drivers, hoping the man wouldn't think I was beeping at him. Somehow, everybody just sat there. After a moment, I said to my sister, "Can we help him?" She took the hint, got out of the passenger seat, and approached the man. By this time, he'd gotten close to the edge of the roadway, with the apparent intent of entering the shopping center. But the approach was uphill, and if he'd been getting very little traction before, now he wasn't getting any. I saw my sister speak to him, then take the handles of the wheelchair and begin to push. She maneuvered him up the driveway and across the parking lot to a Burger King, then got him inside. When she got back in the car, she told me that when she asked, "Can I help you?" his first reply was, "Yeah, you can call the city and tell them to shovel the snow out of the bus stop." He'd intended to take a city bus, but found the stop unnavigable for his chair. So he tried to cross the street to get to a place in the shopping center where he could call a cab, not realizing that the amount of snow and ice in the street wouldn't let him get across the intersection in time. That's when we, and at least half a dozen other cars, came along. I don't know what all of the other issues in that man's life are. Possibly there's some alcohol use involved. But I do know that, from now on, when my sister and I are feeling burdened and disconnected, we can look at each other and remember that it could be worse. We could be in wheelchairs at 74th and Greenfield, looking at six pairs of approaching headlights, pumping our arms as hard as we can, and not getting anywhere. trying to keep the routines simple and the intersections clear. This is Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio.
By Jove.
Madison poet Yvonne Yankee.
I am in this with all my heart, but the gods have failed me. I could name them all while I wait for words to squeeze out of my pen like paint from a near-empty tube. They don't care. Your problem, they think. The words are there. I feel them pushing and jostling for space among the commas and the line breaks. I thought the falling snow would encourage them to begin. Wrapped in sophisticated metaphors, they would have pity on this poet who only wants what's hers, just a little verse for the new year. This is Yvonne Yankee for Mind's Eye Radio.
One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names, and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last, or next to last, of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. Here's poet Judith Zuckerman.
Dear friend, thinking of you, lying in intensive care, I stare outside my window at the last raspberry clinging to its stem. I breathe with every hope your scrappy spirit will hang on to life. We have more good times to enjoy. Don't lose, dear friend. Don't lose.
Sukkot, the Jewish festival of huts, is a harvest festival of fulfillment which falls in late September or October each year, gathering in the benefits flowing from repentance and forgiveness from the Jewish High Holy Days just ending. The harvest takes the form of joy and peace and harmony in the world. In the sukkah, the fragile field hut with fruit dangling from its roof open to the light of the full moon and stars, those inside the fragile walls feel the joy that for a moment life is so safe, the world so loving, that they can live in these open-ended huts without fear.
Bittersweet. Flames. Red clusters of mountain ash berries and yews cover a seven-branched menorah. Carved from the plywood sukkah wall 3 decades ago. Birds sing outside these frail walls where relatives and friends' voices linger from past years. Today, School children chatter on the pedestrian path. In the trees overhead, blood orange leaves wait to fall. In this fragile harvest hut of peace, far from Afghan civilians who flee in terror, American bombs shatter. Judith Zuckerman, Mind's Eye Radio.
This and other poems by Judith Zuckerman can be found in her new book, Amsterdam Days, along with her just-released CD. Refugee Blues by W.H. Auden. Some say this city has 10 million souls. Some are living in mansions, some are living in holes. Yet there's no place for us, my dear, yet there's no place for us. Once we had a country, and we thought it fair. Look in the atlas, and you'll find it there. We cannot go there now, my dear, we cannot go there now. In the village churchyard there grows an old yew. Every spring it blossoms anew. Old passports can't do that, my dear, old passports can't do that. The consul banged the table and said, if you've got no passport, you're officially dead. But we are still alive, my dear, but we are still alive. Went to a committee, they offered me a chair, asked me politely to return next year. But where shall we go today, my dear? But where shall we go today? Came to a public meeting, the speaker got up and said, if we let them in, they will steal our daily bread. He was talking of you and me, my dear, he was talking of you and me. Thought I heard the thunder rumbling in the sky. It was Hitler over Europe saying they must die. Oh, we were in his mind, my dear, we were in his mind. Saw a poodle in a jacket fastened with a pin. Saw a door opened and a cat let in. But they weren't German Jews, my dear. But they weren't German Jews. Went down the harbor and stood upon the quay. Saw the fish swimming as if they were free. Only 10 feet away, my dear. 10 feet away. Walked through a wood. Saw the birds in the trees. They had no politicians and sang at their ease. They weren't the human race, my dear. They weren't the human race. Dreamed I saw a building with 1,000 floors, 1,000 windows, and 1,000 doors. Not one of them was ours, my dear. Not one of them was ours. Stood on a great plain in the falling snow. 10,000 soldiers marched to and fro, looking for you and me, my dear. Looking for you and me. Before things got incredibly worse for arts funding in this country, performance artist Laurie Anderson worked as artist-in-residence at NASA. Asked in an interview what she liked about her assignment, she said, I like the scale of space. I like thinking about human beings and what worms we are. We really are worms and specks. I find a certain comfort in that. If that thought is true, then surely the inverse might also be. Or so muses poet Sharon Van Sluis.
Here I say, live. The wind rakes through the grass like fingers. There, see it? Sometimes it takes me by the throat. It pulls out my breath to show its strength to me, but it always, always lets me go. I am sitting at the edge of the coming storm front, immense and wild, a gray roiling wave. Its thick tentacles of wind rush over its shifting threshold, fall hard into the field of tall grass. I am asking God for a little help. I don't know God, but if this storm is his, he's a good bet. If I sit here in my white plastic lawn chair out in this tall grassy field, will he notice me here at the door of his storming art? Or would I seem to him, oh, such a small bit, gnat, mite, ant, that delusional, expects traffic on a New York expressway to slow, swerve, interrupt its hurry should this blip pulse of life step out into its current? A Buddhist would see. A Buddhist would catch that small struggling in his wide periphery as I catch in my fingers the spring-wakened flies frantically bashing the kitchen window, as I catch the desperate dehydrated box elder bugs and Asian beetles, and take them outside in my hands. Here, I say, tossing them, live. If God sees as a Buddha, here I am. Here I am at the threshold of you that I am, at the howling edge of your sublime virtuosity. I feel your fingers of wind twine around me. My life is sure to change. December Ides. I feel a sharp twinge in my own sacrum as I watch the stripped white birches whipped and bent double by this mid-December wind. The sunlight is glass hard and brilliant to hurting, grass gone gray, leaves blown far and everywhere. No snow yet, but cold as and wished for, as the violent gusts roughly brush this dry, chilled earth, starkly unclothed, like a weary and sleep-starved woman, sheets pulled roughly away, mute, paralyzed, and blinking, in a state of unbearable display. This is Sharon Van Sluis for Mind's Eye Radio.
Preface to a 20-volume suicide note, Amory Baraka. Lately, I've become accustomed to the way the ground opens up and envelops me. Each time I go out to walk the dog, or the broad edge silly music the wind makes when I run for a bus. Things have come to that. And now each night I count the stars, and each night I get the same number. And when they will not come to be counted, I count the holes they leave. Nobody sings anymore. And then last night I tiptoed up to my daughter's room and heard her talking to someone, and when I opened the door, there was no one there. Only she on her knees, peeking into her own clasped hands. You ever had one of those New Year's Eves when you were longing to just let old acquaintances be forgot and didn't give a rip if they ever came to mind? Writer Bonnie Lake recalls, without regret, the passing of one such celebration.
Now that the holidays have come and gone, it's a good time to recall the worst New Year's Eve that ever had.
Here's the scene. There was an abundance of pastel polyester leisure suits with flock maroon wallpaper, strobe lights, and a bad band, complete with the Elvis Presley impersonator, decked out in a too tight white sequin jumpsuit. Add to this a couple on the verge of divorce, about 150 revelers, tall pink drinks with little paper umbrellas in them, the air blue with acrid cigarette smoke, and one woman who was 8 months pregnant. That would be me. Halfway through the evening, I realized I'd better hit the ladies' room fast. Dodging my way past the flickering dancers, I finally reached the porcelain god. I was worshiping him on my knees, doing what most pregnant women reserve for the morning. About 2 hours before that little ball dropped in Times Square, I had had as much as I could stand of this hilarity. When I asked my husband if he would take me home, he consented. So to my relief, he went to bring the car up. I waited and waited and waited. My husband finally returned with the bad news. The car had been as silent as a Quaker's prayer meeting. We went back inside to the table. The divorcing couple had given up hurling their pointed barbs and now were just sitting, glaring at each other. When we asked them to take us home, a distance of about 15 miles away, they said, okay, why not? Once we got the car going, of course, there was another development. Their heater was on the fritz. Windows quickly frosted. My toes began to freeze over. It couldn't get any worse, I thought grimly. I was wrong. Once we were on the road, the woman in the back seat began a litany of impending disaster. Slow down. Speed up. Careful, you're on the shoulder. Finally, the driver could take no more. Shut up or you can walk home, he barked. She must have taken him seriously, because she quietly settled back in the seat, quiet except for an occasional gasp of alarm. The next morning, the mechanic delivered the final coup de grace about our car. The car had something called a cracked block. We now had a 3,000-pound Ford Pinto paperweight on our hands. Looking back on the evening's fun, I tallied up the damage. There was the cost of the club, the drinks, the dinner, and so-called entertainment, $150. Towing the car to a garage, another $50. The disgruntled mechanic's fee, $250. The dead car, $6,000. There was the packet of Alka-Seltzer that management thoughtfully provided, $1.59. The total came to $6,451.59. Damage done to our nerves, priceless. This is Bonnie Lake for Mind's Eye Radio.
We've all heard the old saw, to make an omelet, you have to break a few eggs. But in the following essay, Esther Cameron reminds us that without a little introspection, the eggs may be broken, but nothing will be made except enemies.
Before you break those eggs, make sure you have a frying pan. I remember my youth as a time of discontent. Why? Personal problems, mostly. I thought if they couldn't be solved, life wasn't worth living. And then as young people, we were always protesting something. The bomb, social injustices, Vietnam. There was cause enough. All the same at that time, the 50s through the 70s, there were many good things, for us at least, and us was a lot of people. Not only upper-class Americans, but also middle- and working-class Americans. Yes, and even some people on welfare, some of whom used it to educate themselves. In the fall of 1961, in-state tuition at the UW was $150 for a semester. The work week was 40 hours, and there were coffee breaks. One thing I remember is the fruit. In the fall of 1960, I bought a dozen huge, deep red Macintosh apples with a taste like Chardonnay for 25 cents. The next spring, a dozen huge Valencia oranges from Florida, sweet as the large midwinter tangerines that peeled easily and fell apart into deep orange sections. Such fruit I may never taste again. And the restaurants. It was easy to find a solid meal that had been cooked on the premises. The clothes, too. Most of them were made in the United States by people who got a decent wage, and the quality was good. There were many interesting patterns, a lot of detail in the sewing. Clothes were more formal then. This formality had its inconveniences, but there was a dignity to it, just as the dolls I played with as a child were more dignified than the Barbies that began to come in the 60s. Formality. On enrolling in college, we became Miss and Mr. No one called strangers by their first names. Using the last name meant that the person had a domain of privacy to which others were not admitted without permission. One's surroundings were pleasanter. When I was a child, we lived at the edge of the city. The city had an edge then. The houses came to the railroad tracks and stopped, and across the tracks was farmland. I remember looking out across the tracks one night, seeing the Milky Way. Doctors and lawyers were not allowed to advertise. The idea was that these were professions of service, and so that wasn't appropriate. Not advertising kept costs down, too. The music on the radio in the 50s was mostly love songs. Songs about people feeling nice about each other, wanting to be together. Most children still grew up with their fathers. A lot of people still read books. And yet ours was a generation that complained, that protested, that called the people who were running things names. We made people angry who liked what they had. What we all had. All right, there was Vietnam. So now there's Iraq. I'm not saying we shouldn't have protested about Vietnam and other things. But maybe if we'd done it with a little more dignity, like not calling people pigs for doing what they thought they had to do. Maybe if we had been able to see things in a longer perspective. Poverty, war, cruelty, oppression. Those weren't the invention of the establishment. They had been with humanity since time immemorial. Yet by some miracle, whose conditions we didn't pause to understand, we had grown up where it seemed that the absence of poverty, war, and so on, could be taken for granted. Never before had so much wealth been spread as evenly as it was. Never before had so many people had a chance. Never before had there been so much faith in the world that problems could be solved. Could we have held on to all of this, to any of it, while mending the system's every flaw? I don't know. And I certainly don't mean to blame the protesters primarily for the well-plotted corporate takeover of American life. But maybe it is time for a different approach, one based on that ancient maxim of Hippocrates, first do no harm. If you set out to remedy some injustice, be sure that in the process you do not unwittingly contribute to the destruction of some good, such as people's trust in each other, their commitments to each other, the belief in our basic good faith. Think in terms of preserving what we have left, rebuilding burnt bridges, creating bonds, helping those you can help. If we don't do these things, then it won't do much good to protest against the leaders the system produces. Let's be grateful for the life we have, for the time and freedom and human connections that are left to us. Let's try to use them and treat them well, for if we don't, things can always get worse. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Madison writer John Morgan.
Inauguration, or it could be worse. What does inauguration mean anyway? Where does the word inaugurate come from? It comes from the Latin word augury, meaning divination or prophecy. So what does prophecy have to do with installing someone into public office? In ancient Rome, the local augur, or prophet, was, as a sideline, given the job of presiding over official induction ceremonies. It is difficult to imagine where the Republicans could find a prophet among their ranks worthy of inaugurating George Bush. Given that their prophets foresaw a cakewalk in Iraq and gave us a quagmire, it is evident that their track record on prophecy is on a par with that of the Roman augurs. Perhaps they used the same scientific means of divination, such as examining the entrails of or studying the flight of birds. At any rate, the results are equal. Why are we inaugurating a president into office who is already in office? Couldn't a self-styled, compassionate conservative government find a better way to spend $40 million than to lavish it on pomp and ceremony more worthy of a monarchy than a democracy? After all, it was our Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, who said, in language not particularly felicitous or diplomatic, apparently emulating her boss and putting her foot in her mouth, that the recent tsunami offered America, quote, a wonderful opportunity to show our capacity for humanitarianism, unquote. This is like saying that World War II was a wonderful opportunity to defend freedom. But, disregarding befuddled phrasing, how did the Bush administration demonstrate their vaunted compassionate conservatism? Did they choose to have a simple ceremony, forego the royal pageantry, and donate that $40 million to tsunami relief instead? Are you kidding? The day conservative deeds match their words, you'll know the apocalypse is here. But it could be worse. We could have a dubiously elected government pretending to promote democracy around the world, while lining their pockets with corporate profits earned by the blood of American youth. We could have a guy who ran several businesses into the ground, promoted to commander-in-chief of the world's last remaining superpower. We could be a superpower, getting its butt kicked by a bunch of ragged malcontents who don't even have a government. We could be in a shadow land where our experiment in democracy has failed. We no longer have a democracy, and we don't have a dictatorship, but we are pointed in that direction. Although it could be worse, it's not too late to turn things around. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
It's not just nitpicking English teachers who have noticed a certain slow yet insidious decline in word usage and proper grammar in public discourse, but writer and teacher Norma Gay Pruitt wonders what will happen if this race to the bottom gets much worse.
My bad, my students will frequently chime cheerfully when they make mistakes. Your bad what? I want to scream. Your bad dog? Your bad attitude? Your bad grammar, I think, grumpily, silently completing their sentences. This use of bad has leaked out of gangsta rap and thus makes us regular citizens nervous by association. And having come up through a time when bad was good and good was boss, cool, groovy, I guess I have to grant my students their right to obfuscate, though I do so wearily. Jeffrey Nunberg, a much more generous guy than I and an actual linguist, defends another common and current irritant, the word like. I'm talking about the one that is not really used as a comparative. In his newest book, Going Nuclear, he says, quote, whatever teachers and critics think, like is more than just an unconscious tick or a filler that people stick in when they are vamping for time. It's a word with a point of view, and speakers can shut it down when that isn't what they want to convey. The word like, he notes, expresses a position vis-a-vis the world, and thus is not really a mistake, but rather an innovation. In this way, like fills a vocabulary need, and is therefore not really an error. He goes on to prove his point rather cleverly. Yet the overuse of like still annoys me. To paraphrase Churchill, who was actually chiding strict grammarians who claim that split infinitives are never correct, this is something up with which I will not put. But I mean it. Similarly, I am irked by those who use real when they want really. She was real glad to be back home, opined a reporter in one of our local newspapers last week. Opined? Did I really just use opined? Now there's a dinosaur word for you. But let's work through this real thing together. Grammatically, real can be an adjective, just as bad is, so real could modify a noun, as in the real thing. What it can't do, at least grammatically, is intensify, as it is made to do in the sentence, it was real fun. Let's suggest a test. Would the person who yodels, it was real scary, shorten the synonymous very to say, it was ver scary? Shakespeare might have done so, but it would have sounded ver weird. Even the bard didn't say quite scary instead of quite scary, right? Though maybe his Scottish characters did. At the risk of being charged with having a tin ear culturally, I'm going to hold on to every syllable of really and insist that my students, those paying clients I am presumably teaching to use standard English, complete the thought when they chirp, my bad. And before somebody gets the idea that I'm one of those purists who believes that the language was created perfect and should be locked in a cabinet lest users muss it all up, I want to say balderdash. One does not have to be a complete fidget to be annoyed by the rampant erosion of acceptable usage. Witness the runaway success of the no-nonsense book Eats, Shoots, and Leaves by Lynn Truss, which is a, quote, zero-tolerance approach to punctuation, end quote. But I'm liberal. In fact, I appreciate and even embrace the inventiveness of some of the slang that filters into mainstream English. But if someone tells me it's his bad, I want to know how bad it really is, or what is really so bad, and moreover, whether it could be worse. This is Norma Gay Pruitt getting her undies in a bundle over very little for Mind's Eye Radio.
It's difficult to imagine things being much more difficult for poet Oscar Morelis, but he is willing to concede that finally things could be, somehow.
I guess it started to get worse when I decided to build my own house in a sweat equity program. And by the time we got to the fourth month of working, and I barely had a roof on my house, I started dating women who thought I was marriage material because I had building materials in my front yard. But the worst thing was, after they moved on, I would read in the paper shortly after and find out that they had gotten married to someone else. And the fourth time this happened to me, I started to wonder, was it me? Or was I reaching the age where one makes those kind of half-baked decisions called marriages? Or was it the house that symbolized that I had organized my life enough to deceive a lender into a home loan? Then I met this Colombian woman who would give birth to my four children. And before that would happen, her mother and brother came to our wedding, and 4 years later I asked, when are they going to leave? Instead, we moved to Madison. I had a new job, smaller house, larger mortgage, but my bosses didn't tell me the employees had chased out the old director and joined together to make my work life hell. And no matter what decision I made, even a good one that they agreed on, it was wrong. I was wrong, and it was getting worse. So I stayed working longer than I could bear, and the employees all walked away except one.
Okay, wait.
I'll do that one over again. So I stayed working longer than I could bear, and the employees all walked away except one, who I had to fire, and he gave me more than enough reasons to change his employment history. Then I published a poetry anthology. My mom died. My children no longer listened to me. But it could be worse, and I know it. This is Oscar Morelis for Mind's Eye Radio.
Who hasn't seen the poster of the bedraggled and terrified kitten clinging to the end of a rope with the too cheery admonition, hang in there? Maybe some well-intentioned soul plastered it above your hospital bed while you observed it darkly, thinking what you would do if you just had the strength. But really now, even the most mundane bits of excruciating homilies beats not being around to be disgusted by them, as writer Paul Thompson has decided.
It could be worse. That might well be the slogan for seniors like me. We're constantly invoking the expression. As one of the members in my senior exercise group, who's a golfer with a pacemaker, declares, It could be worse. I could be on the other side of the grass. But for seniors, it could be worse has an unspoken corollary. It will be worse sooner or later. That corollary is why so much of our humor centers around death or disability. An elderly minister tells me this joke. A lady marries a wealthy playboy, outlives him, then marries a stage performer, and outlives him. Next, she marries a minister, and finally she marries an undertaker. When asked why she chose such different husbands, she replies, "One for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, and four to go." Or consider this story. Two elderly guys are out driving. They come to an intersection. The stoplight's red, but they sail on through. The guy in the passenger seat thinks to himself, "I must be losing it. I could have sworn we just went through a red light." After a few more minutes, they come to another intersection, and the light's red again, and again they go right through. This time, the guy in the passenger seat is almost certain that the light was red, but he's still concerned that he's losing it. He's really nervous by this time and decides to pay very close attention to the road and the next intersection to see what's going on. Sure enough, at the next corner, the light is definitely red and they go right through. The passenger turns to the other guy and says, "Joe, did you know we just ran through three red lights in a row? You could have killed us." Joe says, "Oh, cripes, am I driving?" But despite our fears, at each stage of decline, it could be worse provides a certain comfort. The bad news is that Fred's sex drive is waning. The good news is that he doesn't wet his pants. The bad news is that Mabel's uterus is tipped. The good news is that Mabel herself is still upright. I could continue elaborating on this theme, but the good news is that I won't. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
One could do much worse than heeding the words of the fighter-philosopher Cassius Clay, who said, "Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee." But wait, that wasn't the right quote for the occasion. No, it's another bon mot that we want here, as Fran Rawl reminds us.
Cassius Clay said, "The legs are the first to go." People die, other people, even people I know while I sit reading in bed. It's so astonishing, this advancing age, like wading through deeper and deeper water. The mind may be high, but the water keeps rising. Suddenly there's too much skin hanging around, flapping. Inside I can hardly see my way through, peeking out in all directions. From medieval times, there's been a silver cup chained to the outdoor drinking fountain at Winchester College. They thought that silver made things pure. Where's my silver cup? This is Fran Rawl wondering for Mind's Eye Radio.
Things could get worse than the late arrival of the morning paper, but some mornings it doesn't feel that way for poet Lynn Patrick Smith.
My paper boy is sleeping in again, so I'm staring at some scare tactic infomercial about my body's bankrupt enzymes being the reason for the recent demise of my high energy level and how they don't replace themselves. Of course, this doctor has a remedy that is so obvious someone should have already thought of it. He doesn't want a Nobel Prize, just $39.95. Yesterday it was the rolling fat burner wheeling its way into my living room, promising to cure all my ills as I coast back and forth across the floor on its patented caster wheels, literally feeling the results in minutes. I'll tell you, I can tolerate lactose, and I'm not lacking essential nutrients available in convenient powder mixes now with 5 fresh flavors, and I have no burning desire to relive the 70s with the bell-bottom rock CD collection. I don't even need ginkgo biloba to remember why I feel out of sorts. It's because the world is starting up, and I'm sitting here with a cup of coffee and no newspaper. This is Lynn Patrick Smith, and I guess it could be worse, but I'm still waiting.
Casey at the Bat by Ernest Lawrence Thayer. The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but one inning more to play. And then when Cooney died at first and Barrows did the same, a pall-like silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought, if only Casey could but get a whack at that, we'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a hoodoo while the latter was a cake. So upon that stricken multitude grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and men saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second and Flynn a-hugging third. Then from 5,000 throats and more there rose a lusty yell. It rumbled through the valley, it rattled in the dell, it pounded on the mountain and recoiled upon the flat, for Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile at Casey's face. And when, responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat, no stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance flashed in Casey's eye, a sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone on the stand, and it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rustling tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the dun sphere flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two!" "Fraud!" cried the maddening thousands, and the echo answered, "Fraud!" But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain. And they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. Thank you. There now, didn't the show make you feel just a little bit better? Even if you received a little guilty pleasure at the expense of others' plights, we here at Mind's Eye Radio forgive you. We really do. So buck up, turn that frown upside down. Every cloud has a silver light at the end of the tunnel, right? Things could be worse. That's our show. Thanks for listening to It Could Be Worse by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. The show's produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Today's optimists include Esther Cameron, Rano Catalani, Bonnie Lake, Kathy Miner, Oscar Morellis, John Morgan, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Paul Thompson, Sharon Van Sluice, Yvonne Yankee, and Judith Zuckerman. Original music by Barbara Chusid. For more information on Mind's Eye Radio, go to www.mindseyeaudio.com, or you can hear this and past shows at www.radioforall.net, and that four is the number four. I'm Greg Williard. Next time, best wishes. Till next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.